Well, as I just mentioned last week, we started into David's life, and just briefly, I'm just going to hit some bullet points, but the whole point of this study is really I wanted to look into David, both his successes and his failures, and look at things that we can learn from both of them, and probably we can learn more from his failures than from his successes. That's usually how it works. David was a man after God's own heart, we read. He started off as a lowly shepherd, youngest brother in his family, but he was courageous. He went and volunteered to fight Goliath, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. He did fight Goliath, and of course, if you know the story, and most people do, he won. And he wasn't taken seriously because of his youth, and he overcame a lot of odds. And you know, it said he was a stripling, which I have defined before. I think that's a young, like an adolescent kid, probably like an early teenager aged kid. So he was just a young lad going up against this 9-footer. And that's what I'm going to talk about this evening. But he experienced victory very early in his life, and a lot of people, that would go right to his head. And David, it didn't anyway, and not in the beginning. You know, they said, as we'll see later, he would come into town and the ladies would cry that Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s, and it yet says that he behaved himself wisely. So it never went to his head for a while anyway. And so what I want to look at is Goliath and David's great victory over him. And before David, so last time we left off, David went to take food and supplies to the battle, and he sees this big Philistine coming out there and defying the God of Israel and making a big show, and David volunteers to go out and fight him, and Saul doesn't think he can do it, but David insists that he can. So if you look in 1 Samuel 17, I'm just going to go through this, and I'm going to draw out some points, spiritualize the passage, as you could say, and look at some of the things that David did and how we can learn from them and apply them to our own lives. 1 Samuel 17, 38 and 39. So before going to the battle, David was offered armor to protect himself, but he rejected it because he had not proved it. And 1 Samuel 17, 38 and 39. And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put an helmet of brass upon his head. Also he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David took them off. So Saul gives him all this armor, gives him a sword, coat of mail, a brass helmet. You can imagine what that must have felt like to be wearing a brass helmet, a coat of mail. And I assume that the coat of mail was probably for a full-grown man, and here David is this young kid, basically. So David, realizing that he hasn't proved them, says, now, I mean, these things are going to be more of a hindrance to me than anything else. And looking into a New Testament parallel, we're told in the New Testament that we're to prove all things, hold fast that which is good. So if you look at this spiritually, don't just jump into something and take it hook, line, and sinker before you've proved it out, right? 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 21. 1 Thessalonians, oh, that's 1 Timothy. 1 Thessalonians 5:21. It says, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. So that's why David wouldn't take the armor, because he hadn't been able to prove it, and he wasn't going to hold fast to it, when it would have probably been more of a liability to him than an asset. And we're also told in Ephesians 5 and verse 10 that we're supposed to be proving what is acceptable unto the Lord. So when you prove something, you're going to put something to the test. And that's what David was not able to do. We should also prepare to defend ourselves, like David did, but safety is ultimately from the Lord. So David didn't, it's not, and I will get into this in a second, he didn't not take any armor with him or anything to defend himself, but he realized that his safety was going to be of the Lord. Putting a big coat of mail on and a brass helmet and all these things and this big sword wasn't going to save him. If anybody was going to save him, it was going to be the Lord was going to save him. I mean, his odds were obviously against him. And we read there in Proverbs 21 and verse 31. This is such an important text, I think, for any any period of time, but especially in the one that we live in too, where we live in a country where we have the most powerful military in the world, and we gloat about that, and we think that nothing could ever happen to us. But it says in Proverbs 21:31, the horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. So you can make your preparations, and you can have your powerful military, you can have your concealed carry and carry your gun with you and everything else, but ultimately, safety is of the Lord. So, you know, I take from that passage, prepare your horse, prepare it for the battle, don't tempt the Lord and not make any preparations, but don't also go in your own strength and think that you're going to be able to win all the battles on your own. We shouldn't trust in our military for safety, but we should trust in God. I got a couple verses here for you in Psalms, in Psalm 20 and verse 7. This is precisely what David was doing when you're going up against somebody that's probably at least twice as tall as you are and several hundred pounds heavier. You better be trusting in the Lord and not in your own might. In Psalm 20 and verse 7, says, some trust in chariots, kind of like our country, and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. So there's a place, and I don't remember where it is, and it says, cursed is he that trusteth in man. You don't want to put in maketh flesh his arm, or maketh, I think that's what it says. You don't want to be one that trusts in men or in your military might, and you could apply that to today. You know, some trust in cruise missiles, some trust in bunker buster missiles, some trust in Apache helicopters or F-35s or whatever, you name it, M1 Abrams tanks. But we, if we're smart, will remember the name of the Lord our God. We know that the Lord is the one that ultimately gives the victory. And if the Lord can smite an army like the Assyrians and wipe out 185,000 of them in one night, well, we better be not high-minded, but fear that God could wipe us out too very easily. In Psalm 44, 6 through 7, this is, I think the other one was a Psalm of David. I think that this one is not. I think Psalm 20. So it's interesting, some of these Psalms, if you think about David writing them and then think of some of the situations that he was in, interesting there. That was a Psalm of David in Psalm 20. So yeah, some trust in their chariots and horses, but he says, we'll remember the Lord our God. And David was a prime example of that, not trusting in the armor, but trusting in the Lord. In Psalm 44, 6 through 7, it says, for I will not trust in my bow, neither shall my sword save me, but thou hast saved us from our enemies and hast put them to shame that hated us. In God we boast all the day long and praise thy name forever. Selah. So don't trust in your bow and don't trust in your sword, but trust in the Lord. It's a vain thing to trust in our advanced weaponry or our military might for deliverance if we fear not God and we don't hope in his mercy. And that's another one that the psalmist said. Let's see if this one was David. I don't remember. Psalm 33, 16 through 19. This doesn't say a Psalm of David. You know, there's several of these psalms in here. And I can point them out at another time. Actually, I think Psalm 2 is one of them, where they are Psalms of David, but they're not listed as Psalms of David. Mm-hmm. Psalm 2 is one of them. And you know that because Peter quotes in Acts 4, Psalm 2, and attributes it to David. And there are several other ones. There's one I just found in, I think it's in 1 Chronicles, that psalm, and I don't remember where the psalm was. I don't remember which one it was. But that whole psalm is virtually quoted verbatim in 1 Chronicles, and it was David that was speaking it, and you find the matching psalm, and it was not listed as a Psalm of David, but it was. And there's a few other ones in there too. So who knows? Psalm 33 might have been a Psalm of David. We don't know. But Psalm 33, 16 through 19 says, there is no king saved by the multitude of an host. Host is an army. A mighty man is not delivered by much strength. An horse is a vain thing for safety, neither shall he deliver any by his great strength. Behold, the eye of the Lord is upon them that fear him, upon them that hope in his mercy. And, you know, those things back then, like horses And what was the other thing that they said? Oh, and host, yeah, that's which is a military. But a horse would have been your one of your primary modes of defense or of offense back then. I mean, that would have been your tank or whatever. You know, that was a powerful military instrument. But it says that it's a vain thing for safety if you're not trusting in the Lord, fearing in the Lord, and hoping in His mercy. So it's ultimately the Lord that gives the victory. I would say that a good rule of thumb for any of us in any situation is to pray to God and then to take reasonable measures and trust Him with the results. And Nehemiah is a great example of that. If you remember when Nehemiah, when they were building the wall of Jerusalem again after the Babylonian captivity, they all got ransacked and hauled off to Babylon, and the most of the wall was broken down, the city was destroyed. And then under Nehemiah and Ezra, they came back. They even got some money from the king of Persia. They came back and they started to rebuild the wall, but they had a bunch of adversaries there. Tobiah, I think, was one of the guy's names. I'll get that for you in just a second. In Nehemiah, did I give you the verse reference? Nehemiah 4:9. But as they were rebuilding this wall, they took precautions and prayed to the Lord, but they also set a watch just to make sure that things were going to go okay. So, you know, there has to be some balance between trying to make sure you protect yourself 100% and don't lean on the Lord at all, or the other extreme where I'm just going to trust the Lord, I'm not going to buy insurance, I'm not going to lock my house, I'm not going to do anything, and the Lord will protect me, which is could be tantamount to tempting the Lord. So somewhere you have to have a good balance in there. Yeah, and I should have been turning. Nehemiah 4 and verse 9. So I'm going to start reading in verse 6 to get some context. It says, so built we the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work. And boy, isn't that important. The people had a mind to work. And that's one thing, if I could just interject this, that we're really losing in this country is just a good work ethic and people have a mind to work. And that's what the welfare state does to you. Eventually, especially if it's generationally, you have no work ethic whatsoever because you just get used to the handout, and that's a terrible thing to do to people. But anyway, verse 7, but it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. Nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God and set a watch against them day and night because of them. So I think that's a good principle to live by. We prayed unto God and we set the watch. We didn't just pray unto God. We put the watch out there too. And these same guys, it's interesting, actually just over in verse 17 of the same chapter, when they were building, they were armed as they were building. This is pretty interesting. What I take from this is there's nothing wrong with taking your gun to work. In Nehemiah 4:17, and they which builded on the wall, and they that bear burdens with those that laded, every one with his hands wrought in the work, and with the other hand held a weapon. So they've got a trowel or a hammer or something in one hand and a sword in the other one, and working and defending themselves at the same time.
I had a note here that they about to have a study on this because they split their time up with both. They finished their time up on the work, and then they took their stand on the walls.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. God has promised us that He will protect us from the assaults of our enemies. And here's got to be one of my favorite verses. And I probably say this all the time about different verses, but this has got to be one of my favorites along these lines anyway. In Isaiah 54 and verse 17. Sorry, I should tell you before I start talking. Yeah, Isaiah 54:17. This one I believe is on the signature of one of my emails, either on my computer or my iPhone. Anyway, one of my favorite verses. Isaiah 54 and verse 17 says, no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord. And I take some great comfort in that. As a servant of the Lord, and we all are, that God says no weapon that's formed against you is going to prosper. And every tongue that will rise up against you, thou in judgment thou shalt condemn. I just think of all the assaults that have happened to the church over all the ages, and they haven't won yet. You know, they may win a small battle here or there, but they don't win. Their tongue can rise up in judgment all you want, and all you have to do is say, "Thus saith the Lord," and you can condemn them just like Jesus did. Whenever the devil was tempting him over and over again, every time he just goes back to the Word, and he condemns everything that he says. And it's not because of us, but it's because that our righteousness is of me, saith the Lord. That's why you're able to condemn anybody that's going to condemn you. And their weapons aren't going to prosper against you. So rather than use the armor that David hadn't proven and wasn't familiar with, rather than do that, he stuck with what he knew, and he took 5 smooth stones and a sling, and he went out to meet the giant that was far more powerful than he was. So you talk about a step of faith. If you go back to 1 Samuel 17 and verse 40. Because David had used this, and I think I talked about this last time, David had used this sling in the past, apparently, whenever he was keeping the sheep and the bear came out and the lion came out. So he knew how to use this one, and he was going to go with what he knew. 1 Samuel 17, 40 through 41. And he took his staff in his hand and chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip, and his sling in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare his shield went before him. So here David, I mean, if you can just picture this, here's this little stripling with his little sling and 5 smooth stones, and here comes this great big giant with a sword that weighed I can't remember how much, and a shield, and I think if I remember it, I thought I did. I calculated out how much the tip of Goliath's spear weighed. I don't know why I don't see that. Oh, here we go. It's over in 1 Samuel 17:5. Let's see here. It says, and he had an helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. That coat would have weighed 83.3 pounds of brass. So here's a guy who's wearing a coat that weighs 83 pounds. That's about as heavy as the body armor that I had to wear in Iraq, as I remember it anyway. I don't think it was quite that heavy, but it felt like it.
The center notes here say that he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. And margin notes says about 180 pounds.
Oh, yeah?
Damn.
I wonder. Huh. And it depends what the shekel is. There, if you look up the shekel in the dictionary, there's various ones, and
yeah.
Wow, but 108, well, 80 or 180, something was...
180 would be just to show you how big...
Oh, yeah.
It says about the number 6 footnote was weighs about 21 pounds, so let's see if I can find number 6. At any rate, the weight...
The greaves of brass upon his legs. Wow.
So, I mean, the guy was quite bogged down.
Yeah, and verse 7, and the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. One bearing a shield went before him. The calculations that I got was 10 pounds. So the tip of his spear, I mean, you ever swung a 10-pound sledgehammer?
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty heavy, right? You can imagine if you're carrying a spear with just the tip of the thing weighing 10 pounds. So here comes this little kid up against this giant 9 feet tall. His coat of mail weighs more than David does, and David's got a couple of stones and a sling. But as we remember in other stories in the Bible, God is able to save by many or by few. So God doesn't need somebody with superior might to win. God can do whatever he wants. And in fact, God likes winning by few. God likes showing his might by choosing weak and simple people to win his battles for him. And I got a few verses on that in a minute. In 1 Samuel 14 and verse 6, this talks about God saving by many or by few. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised, it may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. Amen to that, Jonathan. So, I mean, an excellent example of this was Gideon with his army of 300, beat out the Midianites, I think it was, with, I think they had, and don't quote me on that, I think it was like 30,000. It was a lot of men anyway. But, yeah, I mean, an army many, many times their size. And if you remember, I think Gideon started out with like 10,000 or something. And God said, no, that's too many. That's too many. I want to make sure everybody knows that I'm winning this battle, not you. So he weeds them out. So anybody that's fearful or faint-hearted, let them take off. And they take off. And then he takes them down to the pond and has them, you know, drink water. And one that drank it one way left. And the one that drank it the other way stayed. And so anyway, he got Gideon down to 300 where he could, you know, where it would be definitely obvious that it was the Lord that was doing it. God's faithful followers, as we read in Hebrews 11:34, through weakness are made strong. And Gideon was one of those ones that was listed there in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, this is the chapter, the great chapter of the heroes of faith. Hebrews 11 and verse 34. This is speaking of a bunch of them, and Gideon was one of them in verse 32. It says, quench the violence of fire, escape the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in flight, and fight, turned to flight the alien or the armies of the aliens. So yes, they were out of weakness were made strong. And there could be a lot of those, a lot of examples of that in the scriptures, certainly. You know, Paul was one of them that God's, you know, Paul had the thorn in the flesh and he went to God and asked him to take it away three times and God said no. And there was a reason for that because, well, a couple reasons probably. One, so that Paul wouldn't, through the abundance of the revelation, that he wouldn't be filled full of pride. And then secondly, so that Paul would know that his strength, that any strength that Paul had was coming from the Lord. We read there in 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 9, the famous words, I'm sure we've all repeated them probably to ourselves many, many times. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. So yeah, God's strength is made perfect in our weakness. And that's why he allows things to happen to us. He allows us to have those thorns in the flesh, whether they be physical infirmities or mental infirmities or job loss or whatever. He allows things like that to happen so that we know that any strength that we have to get through it is from God, that his strength is made perfect in weakness, and that anybody can see, you know what, this person made it through because of God's strength, not because of their own. God makes preachers out of earthen vessels so that all will know that the power is of God and not of them. And I added this one for my own sake. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 7. It's good for all of us preachers to be reminded of this once in a while, just in case we get too big for our britches. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 7, Paul says, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of men. And that's generally what God does. He chooses earthen vessels, pieces of, I like to think of it as a piece of clay that hasn't really been refined in the fire long enough yet and dried in the kiln, and it's still porous and it's leaking and it may be cracked or broken or something. And that's where God puts the treasure in so that everybody can see that the power is of God and not of men. And they can look and say, wow, God can use anybody if he can use that guy.
Well, so, in fact, the last word is not of us, so he refers right to him personally. Yep. Rather than broadly saying men.
Yep.
I mean, this is where I think when you see Paul and his humility,
He
points it right back
at
himself.
Yep. And in other places, he said he wasn't a whit behind the chiefest of the apostles. So, I mean, he was right up there with the best of them, and yet he recognizes that, well, as he says in Romans chapter 7, that he said, I know that in me that is in my flesh dwelleth no good thing. And so, yeah, certainly. He's the pattern of pretty much everything for us, of humility, of success, of everything. God has chosen the weak to show forth his strength. Another one of my favorite passages in 1 Corinthians 1:25. I just love this. I've been doing quite a bit of debating with atheists in the last couple months and meeting up with atheists. And it just kind of, I just always think of verses like this, you know, where they think they're so smart and they have all their scientific knowledge, they think, and everything, and yet just some simple little Christian can just point to him or point to a verse and say, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and right there it is. I mean, you know, they think they're so wise. So anyway, 1 Corinthians 1:25 through 27. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For ye see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. And I think it was Queen Victoria that said, I may have mentioned this before, but she said she thanked God for the letter M, because it doesn't say not any, not any noble are called, but not many. So she apparently was a humble queen herself. But yeah, if you think about it, I mean, how many wise men of the world are called? How many wise men are Christians out there? You know, how many of the chief scientists, the chief economists, the chief politicians, how many of them are believers? Not too many of them. You know, God has chosen the simple, not the wise, not the mighty. You know, how many of the people that attend the Bilderberger meetings, the mighty men, you know, how many of them are believers? Probably zero, I imagine. So, I mean, the mighty in this world, generally they're not the ones that are called.
You don't ever hear a lot about them either, both historically or even currently, that get converted.
No.
It's rather interesting, because as you go back and look at the, how many of those throughout history, were ever really then said, hey, I was on the wrong side. And the occasional time you do find one that had all the power and all that, it's so remarkable. But then, of course, their careers are shot.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
Because then they're not going to get back into the power of the game.
Yeah, and for most people, it's just, they just can't give up the fame, the power, it's just, it's too much. I read a great quote from Matthew Henry today, doing some studying back in Genesis. I don't know. He said, he was talking about the mighty men back there in Genesis 6, and he said that few people that actually have the power to control others have enough power not to control others. And that's not the exact quote, but basically somebody that has the power to be an absolute authoritarian and control everybody rarely has the power, to control their own spirit and to restrain themselves to not do it. And I thought that was such a good quote, and I totally botched it up, but
no,
you get the point, though.
That very thoroughly with Matthew Henry, but that's true of powerful, quote-unquote, people.
Yeah, well, as they say, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. Yep. And verse 27, 1 Corinthians, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and base things of the world, and things that are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught the things, or to bring to naught things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. So yeah, God has chosen simple people like us. And he hasn't chosen all the mighty and the wise and the geniuses and everything. Though, like Isaac Newton, I mean, he was probably a genius. He was a real smart guy, and he was a believer, and there were people that were. But generally speaking, not usually. If you look in Psalm 119 and 141, would be a good cross-reference comparison with this one. And that's okay. I'd rather be just a poor, weak dummy and be called of God, and have eternal life, than be a poor or be a powerful, rich, and super intelligent person and not be called of God. And so.
But if that's all you thought there was going to be,
yeah.
Then, like I've heard so many times of the pastors say it too, rather tongue in cheek, if this is all there is, why wouldn't you go out and get it?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you go out there and just stomp all over and get everything you have fun every day,
eat, drink, and be merry,
or tomorrow you die, so you can kind of get a sense of where they're coming from, sad,
sure,
and unfortunate, but true, but then again, that's God's plan, and not ours.
Yep. Yeah, this is all the heaven they get, and this is all the hell we get.
That's exactly right. Yeah, thank God. Yeah. Thank God.
Yep.
Yeah, good point.
Psalm 119 and verse 141. Psalmist says, I am small and despised, yet do I not forget thy precepts. Like it says, I think it's in Zechariah, who hath despised the day of small things. Yep, I'm small and despised. And the Lord gives power unto the faint and increases the strength of them that have no might, and he gives strength for them to continue on. Are you looking at Isaiah? Another one of my favorites. I think I've quoted at least three of my favorite verses tonight. Isaiah 40:28, and if you don't recognize the reference, I'm sure you will recognize the verse. This is, I'm sure, one that has brought many people much comfort over the years. In Isaiah 40:28-31, hast thou not known, hast thou not heard, that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint, and to them that have no might he increaseth strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. Boy, if that doesn't put a smile on your face, I don't know what will. Yep, he gives power to the faint. Even the youth, even the young kids get tired and pass out once in a while. But they that wait on the Lord renew our strength. And you can imagine whenever our days down here are finally through and we take our last breath and up we go, and just to have limitless energy and everything else and no pain, your feet aren't going to hurt you anymore, and won't that be something?
Yeah, as you get older, as you get up in our age, the senior age, that those words even have much more impact on you. Because
yeah.
We were at a nursing home today, and it really is easy to see how people would get faint.
Oh, yeah.
In it. But as I left, I had to think about even faint looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
It was somewhat depressing.
Oh, yeah.
Seeing a friend of ours.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Faint.
Blessings is what I need there.
Yeah. I'm sure that's probably why a lot of people that go into nursing homes don't live that long in there either, because you would get depressed and being around it, I would think.
Later on we'll talk about it after the message, but there were some things that just hit me today that boom.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it makes you thankful for what you have. So David went up to meet Goliath with his 5 stones, and Goliath reviled David because of his youth and because of his looks and because of his equipment, and he cursed him in the name of his gods. So Goliath doesn't think a whole lot of David, but he's about ready to have his mind changed. In 1 Samuel 17:42-44. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, Come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. So he's saying, I'm going to kill you, and the birds are going to eat you. So yeah, David is young, he's fair, he's good looking, and here's this big old gruff giant, probably hasn't taken a shower in 3 weeks or something like that, you know, and just some big, rough, gruff, mean guy, cursing him in the name of his gods. But David wasn't. He didn't fear a bit. Even though David was outgunned, he didn't fear. In Psalm 27 and verse 3, I think this one is a Psalm of David, but I could be wrong. We'll see. Psalm 27 and verse 3, it is a Psalm of David, so this would be even more pertinent. This is great. David says, Though an host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this will I be confident. He's not, even a whole army is going to encamp against him, and he's not going to fear. And if you think about it, if God be for us, who can be against us? All they can do is kill you. You know, Jesus said, not to fear not them that can kill the body, but fear him that after he's killed the body can cast a soul in hell. So really, you know, people get all up in arms. What's going to happen? The worst thing to do is kill you. Well, or they could torture you for a while before they kill you. I think that'd be worse than death. But anyway, there's not much they can do to you. And so really, there's nothing to fear. I mean, it's easy for us to say sitting in this nice living room, but truly, there is nothing to fear because we know how the game is going to end. But David was confident in his God, and he told the giant that he was going to take his head from him, that all Israel would know that it's God that gives the victory. So I just love how David defies this giant here. 1 Samuel 17:45. I mean, just if you can just think about it, just some young kid, I mean, just a tiny little kid goes up against this giant, and the giant says, basically, I'm going to kill you, and the birds are going to eat your flesh. And here's this little kid, and he says, oh, no, I'm going to kill you. You know, and I just imagine Goliath is probably just laughing to himself, thinking, what a joke. Verse 45 of 1 Samuel 17. Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. It's interesting. I want to go back and look at one thing. What did the giant said? Yeah, so the giant said that he was going to give David's flesh, thy flesh, in verse 44, to the fowls of the air. David says, not only am I going to cut your head off, but I'm going to give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines to the birds of the air. So the giant says, I'm going to give you to the birds of the air. He says, no, I'm going to cut your head off, and I'm going to give your whole army to the birds of the air. And you can just imagine him chuckling, okay, bring it on, let's go. Yeah, right, whatever, David. So yeah, you talk about confidence, huh? That's some confidence. So when Goliath came to meet David, David didn't wait for him. He ran. He ran to face him, and he slung a stone in his forehead and killed him and took off his head. Let's look at the next few verses in verse 48 through 51, and then I want to bring out some points about that. 1 Samuel 17:48-51, and it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. So David didn't wait for him. David didn't turn around and run. David ran at him. Talk about courage. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slang it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. And David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him, and there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. So old Goliath hadn't even taken his shield or his sword out of his sheath yet. He probably thinks, I don't even need my sword for this little, joke. And David slings a stone right in his forehead and kills him, and then takes his own sword and lops his head off. So what I would take from this is that we don't need to go looking for battles, but when they come, don't run from them, but rather run to meet them. I used to say years ago that I don't go looking for debates, they come looking for me. That probably wasn't really the case, though it may have seemed that way to me at the time. I was probably looking for plenty of them when I was first converted, as many people are. They're pretty overzealous, which is probably something that I should do a study on someday. Somebody asked me about that one time. But anyway, when the battles come, don't run from them. And sometimes, when the battles come to me, honestly, I just don't feel like it. Like debating with some of these atheists and different things. But it's I did that YouTube video on refuting atheism with an iPhone. Well, then somebody responds to it on the wall, and you're either going to delete his comment or else I'm going to respond to it. I'm not going to allow him to, blast the doctrine or whatever and then not respond. It's one thing if he just calls me names or something, but if he's, spewing out garbage about God doesn't exist or whatever, then... So anyway, then you end up with 75 comments on the bottom of the video. But anyway, by the time you get to the end of it, I'm like, I don't feel like doing this anymore. And eventually, you know, you just kind of give them an ultimatum, answer my question or you're going to be blocked, and then you block them. But anyway, it's just after a while, you just get weary and you get tired of fighting. But still, I mean, if it's a matter of defending God and His truth, you got to do it, you know. And if it's just a matter of them calling me names, I'm not too worried about them calling me names. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but names won't hurt me, right? So we need to use the weapons and the armor which God has given us. So God gave David a sling and a stone, and David knew how to use it, and David used it well. And we likewise ought to use the armor that God's given us. If you look in Ephesians 6:13 through 17, God's given us a lot of armor that covers pretty much every part of our body, if you want to think about it spiritually. And He has given us one offensive weapon. Most of our weapons are defensive, but He has given us one offensive one. Ephesians 6:13 through 17. Paul says, "Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand, stand therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness." If there's one thing I think that you ought to take from that, it's that we ought to stand. He says stand about four times right there in the space of just a couple sentences. Stand, stand, and stand therefore. And your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, wherewith ye shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. So here we have things to protect our feet. We're supposed to have our feet shod with the preparation of the gospel. We have our loins girt about with truth. We have a breastplate of righteousness. So there's your legs, your chest, your feet. Let's see. What else do we have there? A shield of faith. So a shield, you can kind of protect various parts of your body. And a helmet to protect your head. And an offensive weapon, a sword, which is the word of God, and prayer, of course. And it's interesting, the only part of the body there that is not protected are the knees and the shins. And you know why that is. Because you're supposed to be on them praying. And if you're on your knees praying, nobody's going to be able to hit you in the shins. That's why your shins aren't protected. Isn't that interesting? So anyway, God has given us all these great weapons and great armaments to protect ourselves with, and we ought to use them. But how often do we not? How often do we not gird ourselves with faith and truth and everything else, and we just get scared, or we run from it, or try to use humanistic reasoning or something else instead of actually using the tools that God has given us? God will give us the victory in the battle to His servants, and we've already read Isaiah 54:17, that no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and any judgment against you you'll condemn. In our battle with sin, we ought to stop short of nothing but killing and dismembering it. And that's kind of what I take from, you know, if I'm going to spiritualize David and Goliath, David didn't just go up there and whack him in the kneecap or something. David sunk a stone into his forehead, and then just to make sure the guy was dead, took out his sword and lopped off his head. So David stopped nothing short of complete and total victory over the adversary. So if you want to look at our adversary, our biggest adversary, the devil's a big one, but our biggest one is ourselves and our own sin. So if we're going to fight against our own sin, you want to stop nothing short of than taking that sword out and lopping its head off and making sure that it's dead. In Colossians 3 and verse 5, Paul tells us to mortify, which means to kill or to put to death. Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. For which things sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience. So yeah, we're supposed to mortify those type of sins. And there's other ones too. If you keep reading there, he says in verse 8, "But now ye also put off all these, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth. Lie not one to another, seeing that ye have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him." So yeah, all those sins we ought to mortify and to kill them. Not just try to, you know, stick them in the back somewhere and you know, shut them up for a while. Kill them, just like David did. Take the sword out, lop their head off. Make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof, as it says in Romans I think that's Romans 15. Let me see if I can get that one. Romans 15. Might be Romans 15. It might not. It might be Romans 13. It is. Romans 13, 14. But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. Don't make any provision for it. Don't give the lust even a chance to conceive. Flee youthful lust. Take care of them when they're young, as Bud was telling us the other day before the church service. And another point, use your weapon, or use your enemy's weapons against them, like David did with Goliath and his sword. You know, use their arguments against them. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceits. You know, just things like that. Use their own, I mean, if they're using an NIV, use their own NIV against them. Show where there's an internal contradiction in their own book. Use their own weapons. Yeah, literally, you talk about taking somebody's sword and killing them with it. Take their NIV sword, which is supposedly the word of God, it's supposed to be anyway, and take their own sword and slay their position with it by showing it them that there's an internal contradiction with their own book. Show them that their own sword is as dull as a butter knife. So, anyway. David also had some great victories in war. Saul made David, after this little escapade there in killing the giant, as you can imagine, David got promoted from being a shepherd to being a commander in the military, which would make pretty good sense. I would have promoted him too if I was Saul. In 1 Samuel 18 and verse 8, and I'm just going to briefly go through a few of these things and we'll be done here shortly. I'm not going to exhaustively cover everything in David's life, because there will obviously be a ton of stuff to cover. But in 1 Samuel 18 and verse 5, and David went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So here David was set over all the people, and the army, over the men of war, and he was accepted by all the people. I mean, this guy, he had the command over the military, and he had popular support with the people. I mean, he was really on top of the world at this point, and he behaved himself wisely. So he didn't even, his success didn't even go to his head, and he becomes some stupid gloating fool. He still behaved himself wisely. I mean, what an example for us to follow, somebody that the success didn't go to their head. David was ascribed to be a greater warrior than Saul by the people. And this is right about the time when David starts to get in trouble. Because whenever the people start to praise him more than they praise the king, that's when envy rears its ugly head.
It's interesting to note that in the Old Testament, you have so many people who became prominent as kings and heads of their governments because of military victories. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was true, and even in our current time, or certainly from Christ's time on, but even up to this day, we hear, you know, Eisenhower really came to power because of his victory in World War II. And there was so many that would, MacArthur, and you just kind of go through it. And yet, our new covenant, you know, says we're not to be, you know, fighting the battle with a physical sword.
Yeah.
Etc. You know, we have our sword here, and we still rely so much today on military prowess and military victory and military superiority, and those that have, you know, brought us through that. At least in some cases nowadays, we get much more of these suit and tie politicians. I think they're
running it.
We had an interesting one last night.
I mean, people really do gloat in the military stuff, that's for sure. Which, I don't know, I think patriotism can be one of the most dangerous things there is, you know, whenever you think that you as a country are exceptional, and, you know, that we're the good guy. I already covered all that stuff in that foreign policy study, but we're the good guys fighting evil and everything, and all of a sudden you can pretty much get away, I mean, your government can get away with murder at that point, literally. If you think that you're the exceptional people and ridding the world of evil. Verses 6 through 7, 1 Samuel 18, 6 through 7. And it came to pass, as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets with joy and with music with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And it's interesting, even way back then, the women still loved the military guys. And that's still the case today. I mean, you know, soldiers come back from war and the women just love it. You know, it's just, there's just something about it. And, you know, I mean, I guess if it was a legitimate war and you were actually protecting, you know, saving your country from demise or something, then it would be certainly an honorable thing. And I can see women getting all in a frenzy about that kind of thing.
The renowned picture from Life magazine at the time, whatever, they always have tried to hunt down that sailor and the woman who was kissing him in Times Square.
Oh.
And that became quite a deal where, and that was just, that was the image of the end.
Mm-hmm.
Of World War II. They got to Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
She just went up and just kissed him just to show appreciation, and he holds her, and, you know, he's kind of, it's a very, and they for years didn't know the two participants, and they found them.
Oh, they did?
Oh, yeah, I mean, they were like, you know, 90 years old or 80 years old.
Now, were they married at the time?
They marched down the street. It was just exactly this. The women you're my savior. You know,
They
did in France, and they did in Italy when the U.S. troops came through.
Yeah.
So, but that was
wow.
That was the image of the end of World War II, was that Times Square picture.
Yep. So this, of course, made Saul envious of David. You can imagine if you're the king and here's some young stripling coming in and the ladies are all, you know, saying, ascribing more, you know, 10 times as many victories to David as they were to the king. That probably didn't make him real happy. Verses 8 through 11. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. And it came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house, and David played with his hand as at other times, and there was a javelin in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall with it. And David avoided out of his presence twice. I'm not sure that I would have went back and played for him after the first time getting a javelin thrown at me.
Playing to the audience.
Yeah. I would have probably said, you know, Saul, I think you can get somebody else to play your whatever it was for you. But the Lord was with David, and he behaved himself wisely, and the people loved him. Verses 12 through 16. And Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him and was departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from him and made him his captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, because he went out and came in before them. So it made Saul even more scared and more wary of David when he saw that he behaved himself wisely. You know, there's nothing worse than somebody that's better than you, and then when you attack them, and they're still kill you with kindness, you know, that, you know, then it is. It really is. Now, David eventually was made king over all Israel. He reigned at the age of 30. He became king at the age of 30, and he reigned for 40 years in 2 Samuel 5 and verse 4. Like, we're skipping a ton of stuff, obviously, but in 2 Samuel 5 and verse 4, David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. He reigned 7.5 years in Judah over Hebron, and he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah in Jerusalem. Next verse 5, 2 Samuel 5, 5. In Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. So he had a full reign until he was 70 years old and died at a good old age and passed the kingdom on to Solomon. We may get into some of that at a later time. But anyway, I hope that some of that stuff about Goliath and David's battle with him was beneficial for us, just to see how God chooses the weak and the despised things and the things that men don't think much of to win his battles for him. David didn't use all the armor. He didn't put his trust in the armor. He used what he knew. He wasn't afraid of the giant because he knew the Lord was with him. David completely eradicated the giant, which would be tantamount to us eradicating the sin in our lives. So just a lot of things. I think a lot of good principles that we can learn from these things. Next time, so this time we learned about David's successes. Next time we're going to get into his failures and how he messed up with women and with his kids. Mainly that was his problem with his, couldn't control his eyes and didn't control his kids. And really ended up just, he was still a good king overall, but when you look at all the misery, like you were talking about the other day, bud, all the misery that he had to deal with, it should really be something that we should really take heed to, because boy, you can be one of God's elect, and you can be a child of God, but well, you can be a child of God that's stinging for your sin, certainly, as David definitely did.